Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
This is Sherry Bayer from All in the Industry. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to another week of the main course.
Happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday. New theme music.
Yes, new theme music. That is my two bestest friends in the world, Chu Fu and Breedlove, who just got back off tour with Lady Gaga. That's kind of, there's some fun stories there.
Happy to have it. It's definitely a little more cheerful than I think some of the things.
Upbeat. Yes.
That were going on today, yeah. Or going on this week in the news. We are Alexis McLaughlin.
And Philip Gilmore.
Sitting in for Patrick Martins, and we have...
Indefinitely.
And we have in studio today, Daniel Sharp of the Meatball Shop.
Hello. How are you?
As well as a guest producer this week, Bob Zahn.
Good morning.
Bob Zahn.
Yeah, that was exceptionally cheerful intro music.
Yeah.
It kind of took me back to that like early 80s like adventure kids movie, like Neverending Story kind of like.
Yeah, well, I keep on telling Chu Fu and Breedlove that has to be like it's totally like a car commercial or like, you know, the end of a romantic comedy song.
Yeah I see.
Perfect,
like,
perfect for Sunday mornings.
Cartoon characters, yeah. Like just kind of like walking off into the sunset.
Aww.
Together, happy.
Yeah. So...
Yeah, so, Phil.
So there was an article in the New York Times that we're going to talk about. Is that correct?
There was a front page article in the New York Times that is just, like, crushing in its realities. So Michael Moss wrote the article. It was a U.S. research lab lets livestock suffer in quest for profit. And it was really powerful. It really affected me this week. So basically, the article was about the mistreatment of livestock and animal in this research facility that is run by the U.S. government. And that was kind of the big expose of the article.
Well, what kind of hit me is, you know, obviously being in the food industry and trying to, you know, be sustainable in my restaurant, I've researched a lot about how livestock are treated at, you know, meat processing plants, and I find that horrifying. And this is actually twice as horrifying to me. It's twice as disgusting and twice horrible than the regular stuff. That's what was shocking to me about the article.
Yeah, I didn't really, I don't even know what really got me so much about it. I'm not, you know, I work for a sustainable meat company, but it's not something that generally affects me so much. You know, I feel for it and I have those emotions, but just reading through this article, and there's some exceptional stories from this veterinarian, I guess Dr. James Keene, I think his name was, just detailing, you know, like the like serious mistreatment and deaths and injuries that came about. And this is, you know, it's a government department. It's a government run facility.
And they're exempt from the Animal Protection Act, if I understand it correctly, from 1966.
Yeah, the Animal Welfare Act. You know, which I didn't realize has an exemption for livestock, like animals used in research.
Yeah.
So it does, like, their rules and regulations aren't applying.
Yeah, the thing I found most troubling was the justification of divinity for the limitation of oversight with I forget who it was that cited, you know, back in 1979, I think it was. And, you know, I mean, to invoke the Old Testament to shield yourself from regulation in a scientific experiment is just so beyond the pale that I don't know what to say. That was the most shocking to me. I was like, wow, okay. There's definitely some, you know, if that's the thought process there, if that's the outset of the experimentation is like, hey, we're going to play God. It's a little troubling how far you can take that kind of thought.
Yeah. Where that's coming from. Yeah. It was really disturbing.
Not to make a case for animal testing ever, but you know, 200 years ago, 100 years ago, 50 years ago, medical research, this, that, and the other, like, you know, pre-penicillin, I can kind of understand a justification, but now it's like, it just seems reading that article that the only reason this is allowed is just for profitability, like just how to make the animal yield more meat without care for their beings. And, you know, like, not that medical testing is good, but I can kind of see 50 years ago, okay, they're experimenting on animals and it's horrible, but it's like, we know better now and there's no justification for them, you know, especially just for profit, you know?
Yeah, no, that's a really great point, because the center, it's the US Meat Animal Research Center. And its goals are increasing profitability, efficiency for livestock markets. And they're setting out to, you know, create animals, you know, pigs, cows, lamb that produce more offspring, yield more meat, and cost less to raise. And they're doing this, they say, for the United States meat industry to help them, you know, give them an edge and compete against other proteins in other markets. But the producers, the ranchers and, you know, producers and livestock, you know, farmers don't, in large number, aren't supporting the work that the center is doing.
Yeah.
And the testing that they're doing, and it's not that they're, you know, it's not that they're looking to cure cancer. What they're doing is they're leaving, you know, they're putting animals in harm's way, kind of pushing the boundaries and trying to, you know, turn a profit. Which is the goal.
And I kind of mentioned something about it, but the gist of it I kind of felt was that today, right now, there's a lot of people that are leaning towards a meat-free diet, and also a lot of people that are leaning towards if they do eat meat, you know, leaning towards eating sustainable and, you know, humanely raised, humanely butchered meat, which that really, you know, kind of put its hooks in me, because it's like they're doing this to, like, make the farmers, you know, raise more meat for less money, because I think the, you know, all the information we're getting now about sustainability is actually hurting the industry.
Yeah.
The bad industry, not the good one.
It's just, you can't tax an animal that much. You can't make a sow, you know, female pig who raises naturally eight piglets, you know, and then increase her litter to 14. That taxes the mother, it stresses the mother, it stresses the piglets. They're trying to create these easy care sheep. Basically, sheep are domesticated animals. They need help during their birthing season. So, you know, during lambing season, you bring your sheep into a barn, into a protected area. They're very vulnerable. And then when they have their lambs, you isolate them together in a thing called a jug. So that they can bond and so that they can get the proper nutrients. And I was up in Vermont last year for lambing, and I really learned a lot of things that are kind of common sense, but, you know, I just hadn't thought of before. But anything more than twins is difficult for the farmer and for the mother, because she can't nurture more than two lambs. Like, you know, if you have three triplets or quadruplets, there's just not enough nutrients in her body to provide for those lambs. So they're trying to produce these lambs and these sheep that, you know, just give birth into open fields without having to have the farmer there. And through that process, they're losing, you know, a fourth to a third of all the lambs being born are dying in the fields.
That's what that part didn't make sense to me. Like, okay, well, let's not do that then, because the end's not justifying the means. Like, okay, you know, like you torture the animal and put it in pain and blah blah blah. But now, you know, they're giving twins and everything's perfect, but it's not like that. They're dying, so I don't understand why they would keep doing it.
I think, you know, and specifically when they were talking about the increasing the calves, so cows who naturally give birth to one calf at a time, are now giving birth to twins. And their argument
or
is
even
like,
triplets.
I didn't read anything about triplets.
Yeah, I think it said triplets, yeah.
But then they're saying, you know, and the calves are dying because it's very difficult for a cow to have twins. And even though they're dying at much higher rates, the center's arguing that you're still getting more meat in the end.
Wow.
It's a happy note to start a Sunday with.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a cold calculation that they make. It's like, if you double this but lose a third, you're still gaining, you know, so much. And that's kind of, you know, where that I don't know, that thought is going. But
me and Alexa were talking about, like, we've all been, you know, drunk at 2 a.m. in the morning, and you're alone, and, you know, the world makes no sense, and you turn on the TV, and you see the commercial for the abused dog, and you start crying. But it's, like, as important as, you know, I'm not advocating abusing dogs, but, like, it's like, what's going on behind the scenes at this facility, or even in common stockyards, is so way worse than a lot of things. But because we have dogs as pets, it's kind of like, you know, it's like, oh, the poor abused dog, this one a dog, or 10 dogs, or 100 dogs. But the thing is that this is like in the tens of millions of animals that are being, like, tortured and in pain every day, which, I don't know.
Well, you know, there's an inherent contradiction with domestication of species and, you know, the idea of, like, humanely raised and for slaughter. It, you know, in the end, they, you know, these animals are here to feed us. We have entered this biological contract with a species. But I think part of that contract is also to, you know, to say that your life will, you know, we're going to care for you in your life and, you know, make your death as clean and painless as possible. And, you know, I think in that article, too, it illustrated with the issue of predation where, you know, the guy was, like, saying, hey, you know, these wolves are picking off, 12 of our lambs, you know, in 3 days. And that's a good example, I think, of where, you know, that is our responsibility. We have bred out the ability for these animals to be wild and be skittish and run away because they make it hard for them to herd. So we breed that out, and then, you know, it becomes our responsibility to fend off wolves for them. Like, that's the agreement that we make. So, you know, I think that in the end, we have to kind of always come back to that, like, hey, what's the side of our bargain that we have to hold up?
No, it's an excellent point.
I mean, it really is. It's, you know, there's a beautiful transaction between raising an animal humanely, butchering it humanely, treating it with dignity from beginning to end. Mm-hmm. And then the other side of it is just basically slavery. It's, you know, it's horrible. I don't like it.
Yeah, I was just, you know, I'm really excited to see this article on the front page of the New York Times. I mean, it was just, that's a huge position for, you know, that's it's giving this topic and this conversation and really, you know, pushing it to the front and center, which, even though we talk about animal rights all the time in the media and, you know, everyone's has, you know, exposure to animal rights issues in the conversation, but I think there's a lot of it when you talk about something over and over, you start to ignore it more easily. And I thought that this was a really powerful way to bring it back.
I kind of had an epiphany the other day. I was thinking about, you know, who passes the laws that, you know, affect meat production. And the funny thing is that everybody knows about the tobacco, firearm, and alcohol lobbyists. But the funny thing is that there's some people that are into guns, there's some people that are into tobacco, there's some people that are into alcohol, but basically the entire country eats meat. And so it's like almost like, I think the lobbying power of the meat industry is like this thing that people don't realize. They do have power, you know, it's a huge industry. And because everybody eats meat and everybody, you know, consumes it, I think it's just this kind of, like, you know, kind of hidden thing that nobody knows about. Yeah. I don't know if that rings true or not, but
push under the rug a little bit.
Yeah.
Man, there's got to be a happier topic on a Sunday to bring into.
Aw.
So Coca-Cola is trying to get into making milk,
which comes from cows and they're abused. Sad.
Oh, man.
Yeah, but they had the genius. They're like, we're going to make milk. We're just going to add more sugar.
Yeah.
Can you make my milk taste more like Coca-Cola? Yeah.
It's like, if we don't have enough ways to get processed sugar into our bodies, that Coke is finding new avenues.
Yeah, I need another thing that'll make me fat. Looking for it.
I don't know. I think that's like... I mean, the Got Milk campaign did a lot to make milk cool, and then it kind of went away, and then now Coke's going to try it again.
Yeah, right.
They're, like, going to jazz up milk.
I think milk's gone through also, like, a mini, kind of like the gluten thing. There's been a lot of anti-dairy sentiments mm-hmm. in the last few years, mm-hmm. where it's just like, you know, humans weren't meant to be drinking this, and we can't process lactose, and we shouldn't be drinking milk.
I mean, in the 50s, we as a nation drank so much milk. It's like the consumption has gone way, way, way down over time. And I think a lot of it actually has to do with our consumption of soda went way, way up. But, yeah, I was looking at some numbers and watched. Actually, it was in a wine book, and it was about, like, wine consumption. But they plotted the chart against milk for some reason, because I guess that was the most consumed beverage in the U.S., and so wine, I guess wine has actually overtaken milk in sometime in the 80s. But, yeah, it was just, like, in a ridiculous amount of milk. Like, I couldn't imagine.
So really, really serious question then. Growing up, I hated milk. But I always had, if I was served milk by my parents, whole milk, which is the only milk, if I'm going to drink milk, that I'm going to drink. 2% skim. What do you guys drink?
I can't drink skim for some reason. I just find it weird, but... I love 2%, I love 1%, I love whole. I love the cream top, I love the chocolate.
When I did drink milk, I very rarely do now, but it was always skim. I always like, I grew up drinking whole milk, and then and my mom started buying skim milk, and then whole milk tasted really, like, filmy. You know, you get that fat layer in your mouth, and you're like, oh. And so I kind of, it's like working down. As soon as you go down a notch, I was just like, I couldn't go back up, but
I never drink milk just by itself. But if I have like if I just have like one cookie or like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, I can drink a whole quart. But yeah. Just milk by itself, it would never occur to me to just be like, oh, it's hot out. I'm just gonna have a glass of milk. It sounds kind of gross to me.
Yeah, but. I remember being a kid and just pounding some milk. I was like, ah, milk. Nom 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 nom.
I was always a kid that, like, my parents were forced, like, you can't leave the table until you finish your milk. I don't know. Is
and it's
that
been sitting
an
there for 30 minutes, so it's actually by the time you have
to drink
it,
at this point,
it's
been
grosser.
Sitting there for 28
yeah.
years.
Yeah.
Is that still a thing? Do parents still make their kids drink milk?
I think probably in, like, Milwaukee or, you know, or something, or Montana.
Yeah, in dairy-centric states. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. I just like growing up, and then I found out that, you know, parents weren't actually feeding or, you know, serving their kids whole milk. That was like 2%. And I'm just like, I grew up in like a full fat house.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we just use butter and milk and real fats for everything.
Yeah.
But then learning that supposedly was unhealthy, I just.
Can I ask why is cold milk so good, but milk with ice is so gross? Like.
Because it's closer to skim milk. It's yeah, watered exactly. down and disgusting.
Actually, there can be like, an argument made for whole milk shaken and strained. I've done that before.
Oh, okay.
Extra cold.
What is it? Orange juice with ice also. That doesn't work.
No, I like orange juice with ice. I disagree.
No, that's not a position you're allowed to have. That's wrong.
Maybe airplane orange juice with ice.
You know, like, I think that... it was funny. I was talking to my friend about how kind of our parents would always water down the juice because it's like so strong and like kind of a sign of age is like, I think juice is too sweet. So I like it over ice and it dilutes it a little bit, but I don't know.
I read the thing about orange juice, but it was like, I don't know what year it is. Let's say the 1700s, 1800s, but orange juice was so special. It'd be like a drink for royalty, and they would serve it in, like, you know, 1 ounce glass, and you'd sip it very soon. And then I just think about, like, you know, modern day, you grab like 16 ounces of
bottle. Yeah. I mean, even my grandmother had juice glasses, which were just like little, like 4 ounce.
I mean,
they look like a big shot glass.
Yeah.
I want a big cup of juice.
Bob might remember this. A lot of it. Did you guys grow up with frozen orange juice?
Oh yeah.
Well, Florida, you know, it's funny because when I was a kid, I would go to, I'd spend my summers in Kansas with my father. The frozen orange juice there was kind of disgusting. But in Florida, there would just be like the Publix is like, you know, the you know, local grocery store, their frozen orange juice was actually really amazing. It actually tasted better than most fresh orange juices. But you just take a scoop of it with a teaspoon and mix water in it.
And High Five. Did you ever have High Five?
High Five, yes. High Five was great. High Five.
All right. I think we should probably go to break. But before we do, if you haven't read the article, just go ahead. I'd recommend it to everyone. You can look it up by Michael Moss. It was in the New York Times. Also, the title, again, was U.S. Research Lab Lets Livestock Suffer in Quest for Profit. So do yourself that. And then we will be back with Daniel Sharp.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
We're back talking with Chef Daniel Sharp. He is works over at the meatball shop and helped bring that into its glorious empire that it is today.
First off, there's an important question that I think all of our listeners and me personally want to know. Do you believe in aliens, and have you ever seen the UFO? And were psychedelic drugs involved?
I do not believe in aliens, per se. Well, I do believe in their existence. I don't believe that they have made contact.
Great.
I don't think they care. I think they're out there living a happy life, downloading our TV shows from the 1950s, and have decided that we are pretty much petty and, not worth reaching out.
When they get the New York Times article, how do you think that'll read to them?
Well, I mean, you know, I think that as a species, you know, as we've done enough besides the Times article for them to be highly skeptical of trying to make contact. But no, I wouldn't put that in the win column for us.
Great.
Yeah. Yeah, that would.
So your background, you obviously you're a chef. You're in the kitchen, culinary. How'd you get into it? I know your aunt had a little restaurant.
Yeah, I when I think back on my career, I realize that I've always worked in restaurants, you know, even before I decided that that was what I was going to do. You know, in high school, I worked at a pizza place, and then through college, I was like a busboy and a waiter. My aunt had a restaurant that I would work, you know, spend my summers when I was a kid, and
Was that?
Yeah, that was in Topanga Canyon in Los,
oh, cool.
Like just north of LA. Very idyllic place. It was beautiful. It was like this restaurant where two creeks converged. It was like always voted LA's most romantic restaurant. And she was in her own way like a, you know, a kind of a visionary. She was promoting a kind of vegetarian and vegan and diets before it was very fashionable and in vogue. Not to say that the restaurant always got the misnomer that it was a vegetarian restaurant, but in the 70s it was a vegetarian restaurant because they had vegetarian food as an option. And then, you know, flash forward, you know, 20 years later, everybody's like, I thought this was an all vegetarian restaurant. And you're like, well, no. But yeah, she was She was big into kale back before it was considered edible. And now, you know, everybody's on that bandwagon. So, yeah, it was an interesting place to kind of, you know, spend my summers and grow up in. And I found that's actually where, you know, post-college I was working as a waiter and where I made the transition to working in the back of the house.
What year was that?
It was early 2000, like 2001, 2002. So, yeah, quite a long time now.
Don't date yourself. and so I guess from there you did some traveling too. Did that happen right after you left the inn at Seventh Ray, or?
Yeah, well, there was the first chef I worked for there gave me what I consider some of the best advice I've ever gotten, which was I decided I wanted to pursue a culinary career. And
is this after going to college?
Yeah.
For something else?
Yeah.
Like, all right.
So I was struggling to figure out what I wanted to do, and I was just kind of waiting tables and having a lot of fun, but not really moving in any one direction or the other. So I asked the chef I was working for, which I was going to go to culinary school, because I thought that, you know, natural step, right? And he went to culinary school, and he said, if you want to work in a hotel or, you know, there are some executive chef jobs that you need a degree to have. But he's like, if you want to work in a restaurant, and he's like, you're kind of already cooking, so that's taken care of. And he's like, you're not 18 fresh out of high school, so, you know, he's like, don't waste the money. And his advice was, he's like, go work in Europe. He's like, even if you have to do it for free, you'll probably end up spending less money than going to culinary school. And he's like, and honestly, on a resume, if you say I have cooking experience in Europe and or a culinary degree, he's like, they look about the same. So that's the advice I took. And I found, a job in Italy on some job posting board, which was really funny and fortuitous. And I was like, I got a job and moved to Italy in 2 weeks. And it was,
what city?
Not so much. It was outside. It was in dead center of Italy. It was in Umbria. And it was about 45 minutes outside of Perugia, which is the capital. And it was literally a dirt road off a dirt road up a mountain to this agriturismo. It was, you know, like kind of a bed and breakfasty kind of thing, but there were bungalows situated in an olive grove.
Wow.
Orchard. So it was very picturesque, very beautiful. Although, you know, in retrospect, it was an amazing time, and I wouldn't trade the experience for the world. But just for all of you who are considering an apprenticeship in Italy, it's a little bit code for indentured servitude. Still alive and well. We worked breakfast, lunch, and dinner 6 days a week.
Wow!
So it was a marathon of a cooking experience. It was great. I'm happy that I did it, and I'll never do that again.
How long were you actually there for? That I can't.
It was one week.
Yeah, it was over a summer. It was 4 months. So, okay. Yeah. It was, and then everybody was like, what's Italy like? And I was like, well, it looks like a lot like a kitchen. but we were, we were out there. So you had one day off a week, and, you know, you could either sleep, catch up on that, do some laundry, or, you know, there was a staff car, which was like Fiat Uno. With this little rickety thing. And, you know, if you got up real early, you could drive it down to the train station, which is about 45 minutes away, get on the train, and we were about an hour and a half or 2 hours from either Florence or Rome. So every once in a while, I'd get really ambitious. But, you know, you do then sacrifice that whole week of catching up on sleep. But it was fun. And, like I said, it was a real experience.
How cool is Rome? I lived in Rome for about 8 months. I actually tried to work in Rome. I had a little bit of money saved up, And I moved there to try to find work, and I would do anything. I'd wash dishes. I kind of had a free place to stay there, and it's impossible to work there. Like, you have to be like a rocket scientist or a, you know, brain surgeon, or they won't let you work there. But it was just so great. Like bringing back my videos, like the shortest route to my video store, I had to, like, you know, walk by the Pantheon. Like, I'm like, I don't think I could get sick of this, you know?
Oh, it's so picturesque. I used to, like, take out the car every once in a while, and I would get lost. And what was funny was, in the same way all roads lead to Rome, all roads in this region led toward Perugia, which was the capital. So I would get lost, and then I knew how to get back from the capital. So I would literally drive, get lost, and then I'd have to, like, drive all the way to the capital, and then drive all the way
to find your way home. Yeah. Well.
But I got like 4 flat tires in that car too. I got really good. And
you got really good at getting flats?
Well, no, at changing the tires is what I was going to say. But yeah, I guess I got really good at changing flats. And the proprietor was like slightly annoyed that I kept getting flats, but he also fancied himself kind of a racing driver. So I think he took it as that I was like really like, you know, getting out there and driving the car fast and hard. So he was kind of like annoyed but slightly proud. I don't know, it was weird. He picked me up when I arrived. He picked me up from the train station the first night, and he was driving back to the hotel and in a very, very aggressive fashion that I instantly understood was, like, just basically a pissing contest to see if I would, like, get nervous or blank or, you know. We were, like, doing, you know, 50 miles an hour through these tiny little streets and, like, blowing through towns, and he's like, all Italian drivers are crazy, huh? And I'm like, no, you're good. I'm like white knuckling it over here, but I'm like, don't flinch. Like, he's sizing me up, I can tell. So it was.
Do you guys ever miss driving? I mean, living in New York, I miss driving so much.
Both, I have a couple of people, including my business partner, that has a car, so I get to drive maybe once every couple weeks.
I mean, I'll drive. I borrow a car kind of regularly, but it's just not the same, you know, being in traffic and just.
I miss driving in the sense that I enjoy going fast and, you know, the excitement of really driving. I don't miss traffic and
parking tickets.
Yeah, it's like, you know, just the commuting side, or I don't know. Long distance driving, I don't really miss that very much.
Yeah, I don't like long distance, but I like the idea of going somewhere.
I do miss the alone time, though, that driving. My transition from California to New York, that was the first thing that I really had to figure out, because I drove and I listened to NPR and I got my news that way, and I kind of like collected my thoughts. And when I got here, that kind of that time was gone from my day. So I had to kind of invent new ways to kind of get that back and incorporate it back into my my everyday, because, you know, I found that I was blissfully ignorant of almost the whole, you know, of the world's going on, and, you know, I didn't really ever have a like kind of some really alone time to think about things, you know. So
yeah,
you worked at Chez Panisse, is that correct?
Yep.
How was that?
That was great.
She's my favorite person ever.
Alice is fantastic. She's she used to give these we'd have staff you know, Christmas parties, and then we also had one in the spring. And she gave the most funny speeches. yeah, it was you know, it was, we changed the menu twice a day. I worked in the cafe. when we changed the menu twice a day, it was always something new, you know, a never-ending cycle of great produce and stuff to work with.
Just every day a surprise box came in?
Yeah, you know, it was always something new, and just great stuff.
That's one of my favorite things to do with my chefs, is I'll just order like, you know, 12 gooey duck clams or like a whole goat, and not tell them it's coming. And be like, surprise, get to work. Here, I bought 10 red, red grouse from Scotland. Like, here, take it.
I saw the eels in the other day. I came in and we got freshwater river eels.
Yeah, we got live eels.
Swimming in like a pint container.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was just like sitting in the window.
It was funny because they were pretty. They were not big for eels, but it was funny once you fillet them. The fillets were only about like 7 inches long and a quarter inch thick, but they were delicious.
Mm. I had those. What are those little the baby eels that they do in?
Oh, anguilas.
Oh, so good.
The Spanish thing.
Yeah. They're like a delicious. They look like a bowl of pasta when you get them, and they kind of.
I actually, one of the first times I think the second or third week I was in New York, I love Spanish tapas, and I went to some place, I forget what the name of it was. It was on 14th Street. It's called El Cid.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, long story short, the waiter comes over. Oh, we have one special today. Well, we have sauteed baby eels, and we have an appetizer entree. I was like, oh, we'll get the entree. And okay, so never had baby eels before. Everything on the menu was $5, $6, maybe $10. So I'm eating everything. We get a whole bunch of tapas, and then everything's gone. I'm like, oh yeah, I'm ready for the eels. And he's like, oh, that was it. And it was, you know, it's just probably like 4 or 5 ounces. And we just ate them, thinking that it was some sort of like little free tapas. We didn't even think what, you know, we ordered so many things, we didn't really put it together. And then I get the check, and it's fucking $75. You know, it'd be like, you know, you would think that you think you might want to have said in a restaurant with $6 and $7 items on the menu that, you know, oh, yes, we have our house wine is $5. We also have an $8 wine. And then, oh, I'll take the special wine of the day. Oh, it's $48 for a glass. You know, didn't make any sense. I was really pissed, but, you know, shame on me.
I had them last year when they were in season at 10 Bells in the Lower East Side. I like that. It's a little wine bar tapas kind of place. And I remember they were expensive, but they weren't ridiculous.
Yeah.
I ate there with my sister, who like really took a shine to them.
Yeah.
She was like, it's like pasta without the
they're so good. They're literally about 3 inches long and white, and then they just have one little one little black dot for an eye.
Yeah. They're really delicious. They're very mild too. They're not like, you know,
fishy.
Eels that have that strong taste, but these, they're great. Delicious.
Daniel, do you have a favorite restaurant?
I don't have a favorite restaurant. I don't know. You know, being a chef, you get a lot of what's your favorite food, favorite restaurant. I kind of always struggle, actually, because I'm inclined always to do, like, my favorite thing to cook is something I've never cooked before. So it's, and my favorite place to eat is always like something new. And I kind of battle myself in the sense of trying to go return to places and appreciate, you know, cause you know, obviously, you know, when you're always going to someplace new, it's like a crapshoot. Like it's a kind of 50-50 and opposed to like going back to a place that you really enjoyed. So, but maybe I'll have an answer to that question next year.
It's so ironic that we're talking about this, because I had to fill out some profile thing, and it was like 40 questions. I was in a bad mood, so it was like your favorite cookbook, and I'm like, it hasn't been written yet. And then like what's your favorite question to be asked during an interview? And then I said it probably has to be, and then in quotation marks, what's your favorite question to be asked in an interview? I just like just as vague as possible. Yeah.
I typically hate the favorites questions because I don't ever keep a list of favorites in my head. Mm-hmm. But Phil and I have been talking about favorite restaurants recently.
My go-to thing in an interview, or if somebody asked me, I would just say Momo Sushi Shack. Duh. You know, why would I say any
other
restaurant?
My own restaurant.
Yeah.
Best
restaurant in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did you meet the meatball shop guys?
How did I meet the meatball shop guys? Daniel Holzman and I met at the Inn of the Seventh Ray, my aunt's restaurant. He, after I left for Italy, I returned and I was working at a Japanese restaurant in Northern California, and he
Which
was,
one?
It was in Sacramento and it's now defunct.
Okay,
it was a short-lived but very. It was a very nice restaurant. It was just not. It was a classic example of how to screw up in the restaurant industry.
Wow.
It was not to digress too much, but like the whole project was based around an affair. So that's number one.
Wow.
You know, like this guy was based in. It was a Korean guy who was based in Seattle. And he was having an affair with a woman in San Francisco, and they went out to this they would always eat at this restaurant called Azumo in San Francisco, and they all, you know, they loved the restaurant and thought, well, we'll poach the chef and make our own restaurant. And but, you know, they decided that, you know, we couldn't do it in San Francisco because it was too close. So they chose Sacramento, which is my hometown where I grew up, to do this very high-end, upscale Japanese restaurant. And nobody had ever lived in Sacramento. When I got back from Europe, I was staying back with my parents, and I was very excited to find this, like, really high-end Japanese restaurant that was doing some amazing food. And I thought, wow, Sacramento's really grown up since I've been away for a few years. But no, it hadn't. It was just, it was too sophisticated for that town, and, you know, it was just a bad idea. Anyway, so I was working there, and Daniel Holzman was hired on as the new chef at my aunt's restaurant, and I was still in contact with some friends there, and they kept telling me, like, oh, this new chef is really cool, you should meet him. And they called me up, and they wanted me to come, or he actually called me, because everybody, you know, my aunt and the people there were like, oh, you should talk to Daniel about being a sous chef. And I had absolutely no interest in going back and returning there. But I went down and met him, and we actually hit it off over a discussion of chicken wings, in our devoted love of a good chicken wing and our mutual hatred of anybody who tries to reinterpret the chicken wing, or the buffalo wing, I should be specific.
Wait, what goes wrong with a buffalo wing?
Well, a buffalo wing,
what needs to be right?
A buffalo wing for me is butter and Frank's Red Hot. And if you put your own, spicy sauce, you know, your chipotle, chili, whatever, that's a hot wing. It's not a buffalo wing. If you're going to say buffalo wing, that it's very specific, and, you know, it's not open to for interpretation in my book.
Has anybody ever eaten at Anchor Bar in Buffalo?
No. Is that the inventor of the buffalo wing?
Yeah. I've never been to Buffalo.
They're okay.
It kind of ties back into our conversation last week about fancy meatballs.
Yeah.
And why, I don't know, go through why fancy meatballs aren't a thing or shouldn't?
Yeah, I mean, the meatball in it is like a contradiction, because I think it's it's the first form of deceptive marketing that was perpetrated by our grandmothers. Because the secret of a meatball is not really the meat. It's everything else that goes into it. And it was a way for, a way for our grandmothers and mothers to take and stretch out a very small amount of protein into a larger meal. And the things the characteristics that people, the positive characteristics that people attribute to a meatball come largely from the things that we add in there. The bread makes it soft and fluffy and tender. You know, I often have seen, like, you know, naive chefs say, like, I'm going to make a pure meatball and I'm going to take out all the filler. And you're like, well, then it's going to be dense and gross. Or, like, I'm going to make it out of, you know, leaner cuts. You know, I'm not going to use the... And the grind cuts that we use are, you know, they're developed muscles. They have a lot of flavor. Yeah, you don't want to eat them as a steak because they're chewy. Like, you can't. But when you grind them up, that richness is what, you know, allows the, you know, a little bit of meat to carry the flavor into all the different stuff. You know, the bread and the cheese and
it makes it. It's the money maker of the meatball. Yeah. You got to have the developed muscles and the tasty, you know, flavor, that, all that
rich,
fat.
That richness, and the fat that gets absorbed by the bread. And so it's all those things that kind of work in unison to create this, like, really special thing. And if you try to eliminate them or change them, it really, that's when meatballs kind of go south.
Well, that's what I like about the meatball shop, is that you guys didn't try to reinvent the meatball. It's just the perfect version.
You just do it really, really well.
Yeah.
And sustainably. You guys source really responsibly.
Yeah,
we try to, you know, I think one of the things that our goal is to try to move the dial, and it's not to be like the leader of our industry in that sense, but it is try to move the conversation forward while bringing people into the conversation. So, you know, we're a very low price point restaurant. It's important for us to be accessible to everybody, and then, you know, to try to get them to shift a little bit, little by little. And you know, I think it's important, and something that gets lost in the conversation, I think, is this idea that, you know, sustainable also means economically sustainable, and being being a business, you know, you do have an obligation to your staff and your workers to stay in business, to, you know, to keep going and to keep pushing forward. And and then you have an obligation to your customers to provide value. So, you know, balancing those things and then adding the third, which is, you know, an agenda, I suppose, is a challenge that, you know, we hope that we're moving, you know, we're moving the conversation in the right direction.
You guys are doing a great job of that. I want to thank you for coming on the show this Sunday. We got to wrap it up. But,
yeah, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for coming in.
It was great.
And thank you,
Bob.
Great
Sunday.
Yeah, and thanks, Bob, for some guest producing.
Cheers. All right. Well, have a good day.
Yeah, happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday.
Listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.